Welcome back to the All Else Equal podcast. Today's episode is the second part of our four-part series on the book Angrynomics by Eric Lonergan and Mark Leif.
Yeah, today we're going to tackle the third dialogue, macroeconomics, capitalism as hardware with crashes and resets. As a reminder, the first two dialogues dealt with anger, both private and public. The authors lay out their case for why we should care about moral outrage, a legitimate form of public anger in response to injustices, and also why we should be concerned about tribal rage, another form of public anger that's harnessed by politicians, the media, or other actors in self-serving and ultimately destructive ways. This third dialogue gives a whirlwind history of macroeconomics from 1870 to the 08-09 financial crisis and is what we want to unpack today.
We're also happy to be joined again by John Ivory Winston III. Welcome back, Johnny.
Thanks for having me back.
Does it bother you that you're one number short of Jason Robert Reed?
Yeah, it definitely hurts. It hurts a lot.
That's all right. Someday your line will get there.
You know, John's wife is expecting. Maybe we're going to get us a John Ivory Winston IV.
Nope, she wishes to watch my legacy die in a cold grave.
let's get to it. All right, John. So what did you think of the introduction of the book or the introduction of the third dialogue?
All right. So I think that the beginning of the chapter started off pretty informative and kind of wrapped up the last chapter's dialogues into this next one. So I'm just going to read it out loud. Mark, Eric speaking. We have outlined two forms of public anger. One form, the most pernicious and virulent, is the energy of tribes. It has been exploited by segments of the political classes and the media to motivate a minority that is angry and tribal, polarizes, and it threatens violence and discrimination. Angry minorities can and do win close elections. The second form of public anger, which we need to listen to and address, is moral outrage. People have been neglected, ignored, disparaged, and the political classes have failed to listen to their genuine concerns. Job insecurity, loss of skills, rapid changes in working practices, a loss of representation, wealth inequality, more extreme than anything we've seen since the roaring 20s, political corruption, and a discredited elite. This is political anger as a form of legitimate moral rebuke. It has economic origins, but it has a history and a backstory. Let's try and piece together that story as best as we can. And that's also what we want to try and do right now.
Yeah, right. So I thought that was really good kind of recap that the authors did. And so they start out with, I think, like a really interesting way to describe kind of the mechanism of the economy. And they talk about hardware and software. And so us three have had this conversation a little bit as we're reading the book, like, what do we make of these ideas of hardware and software? And kind of what we gather is that the idea of hardware is really the institutions of a nation and kind of the broad markets that make up some of these institutions. And so they look and think of like the labor market as this big institution, the capital market as this other big institution. The government obviously has a role in the macro economy. And so that's kind of the hardware. Germany would have, you know, really similar hardware to the United States. Other countries would have really similar hardware to the United States. And it's really the software and the configuration of that hardware is what makes each country a little bit different. And so then the software really is how kind of the economy works with those institutions in place. And so that's kind of where they move through in this dialogue as they talk about capitalism 1.0, as being the software. And then they talk about kind of a hard reset in the capitalism 2.0. And then they talk about capitalism 3.0 again. So how these institutions kind of work together to kind of form the macro economy.
Just as a caveat, I hate this metaphor. Like, I really just don't understand the distinction between hardware and software here. But I think I'll just like lay that out or let me just kind of put a pin in it actually. And like that will come back up as we keep going.
I mean, when we teach like principles classes in economics, we talk about this already, right? We talk about, you know, the makeup of economic systems. And so we talk about kind of the spectrum of, you know, capitalism all the way to like communism, right? On kind of the other side of the spectrum. And then how, you know, current governments around the world kind of move throughout that spectrum. And so we're used to kind of hearing this language in a different way. But I could see how, you know, some readers would resonate with this.
I personally definitely resonate with it as an IT specialist by trade. Having things explained to me in terms of hardware and software just makes it super clear. But I do want to,
Hold on. So does that make you the technocrat or is Forrest the technocrat?
Johnny technocrat.
So it should be either the IT specialist or the ivory tower academic that we should trust. Let me think.
It turns out that a podcast to 20 Notre Dame students is run by 3 technocrats. Like that's actually not surprising at all.
All right. Sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead, Johnny.
So I just wanted to go through the things that I think I know briefly about really just 3 versions of capitalism that we've gone through so far. So what they call capitalism 1.0, which lasted from the 1870s to 1945, that was basically just as far as the software goes, the idea that labor, land, and capital that's the basis of capitalism. And an imbalance in one commodity balances the others. Buyers find sellers, workers find employment, and there isn't much need for government intervention.
Yeah, right. I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. Like everything's a commodity at that point.
Yeah, I think that's important too, is that like labor is a commodity in the same way that like oil is a commodity, right? Yeah. It's just some input to production. Mm-hmm. And it turns out like workers might be different than oil. And that's what the author is going to say is like the primary bug of capitalism 1.0.
Cool. And so obviously that ended poorly, because people aren't just a commodity. And when you go through the Great Depression, you have millions of people who have to be unemployed and basically just wait until the market quote unquote corrects itself. Then you've got a really big problem. You've got fascism, communism. But I think we also start to see like the hardware change, as like big government, like New Deal government, gets a rise, and that seems to be where 2.0 starts.
Yeah. This is where I get a little hazy on like what is hardware and what is software. Do we think of like the New Deal as like a set of ideas, these Keynesian ideas of like we can stimulate aggregate demand and pull us out of a recession? I mean, that kind of sounds more like a change in the software to fix the bug. But then again, like, you know, this stuff happened in the 1930s, which is before this 1945 kind of delineation that they're making. So like maybe we should actually take 1945 as kind of like a they make it a hard boundary at some point when they're talking about it, but like maybe we should sort of think 1930s, 1940s being the transition between 1.0 and 2.0.
Absolutely. But I would say that 2.0 would be defined as probably at the center, like labor not being just a commodity. Seeing that people get angry when they're unemployed or way poorer than the richest of the rich. And so that saw a rise in what Forrest already called Keynesian economics, where government is, I guess I would say that investment also, it seems to me like labor is made up of people, and investment, I think, is also made up of people. And Keynes seems to say that investment is the most important.
Well, maybe we should go to like the identities that they're using. I have beef with the identities that they're using too, as like a total story. But like, you know, so they're saying like capitalism 1.0 is this, you know, they're using this quantity theory of money. And it's basically just saying like, here's an identity or an equation that's like telling this narrative of like, well, if velocity is fixed, then the money supply is kind of like determining how prices are changing. So if M grows faster than Q, right, the money supply grows faster than real output, then you get inflation, which is like not a crazy assumption. But then they kind of like tie this to like, well, this is saying something like, well, the government has no role in like ensuring full employment. And that, to me, that it seems like another kind of software change from 1.0 to 2.0, that like, all right, now with this sort of Keynesian economics, we can change aggregate demand through investment and government spending, like investment through monetary policy, government spending through fiscal policy. And like that is going to have impacts on both inflation and employment. And so we can kind of try and like control these things. And then there's some sort of natural trade-off between employment and inflation. This is like this idea of a Phillips curve for those who have been kind of exposed to that idea in macro, that there's some sort of trade-off between employment and, or like stable prices and full employment. And then things get kind of wonky in the 70s and we have to get a new set of ideas. Jason, do you kind of agree?
No, I agree. No, I think that's perfect. Right. And I think, you know, I think it's important to say that, like, you know, that quantity theory of money is kind of been debunked, right? Like it's an interesting place to start because it's a really easy identity to kind of wrap your head around, but kind of empirically, it doesn't really work, you know, really well. The assumptions don't hold great. Yeah. It's not useful.
I mean, it's an equation, right? It's an identity. Yeah. It's like an accounting identity. It's not like good or bad or like, it just is. That's just right. An equation in the same way that like, the y equals c plus I plus g plus x minus m or m, like that is just an identity. It's not the authors are making some sort of normative claim about like what this says about how people view labor and how people view things, but like they're just equations. Like this is just math. Like that's all it is. Math and accounting.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I personally love the Keynesian identity and I love teaching the Keynesian cross. It just resonates with me. Oh, I love it. Forrest is shaking his head, but I completely agree with what you're saying. There's just an identity, right? Just accounting and math.
All right, and so then we get a reboot in the 70s.
So it seems like 2.0 crashed because of stagflation in the 70s, which that's definitely something that I had a lot of questions on. So it's the goal was full employment, right? Under Keynesian economics, and the government, it seemed like it was government that was trying to drive it and regulate, you know, finance and stuff like that. Can you talk more about how like stagflation caused that? Or I think maybe caused the crash?
Yeah, maybe for the listeners, we should just like make sure everybody's on the same page with what we mean by stagflation. So with inflation, we're thinking about rising prices. Stagflation has this like kind of like ominous tone, which means it's even worse than like rampant inflation, meaning that you get a lot of inflation and at the same time you get reductions in output, or at least reductions in the growth of output. So kind of like you kind of think like you're getting a recession at the same time you're getting raising or increasing prices. And you know, when we think about typical monetary and fiscal policy tools, usually kind of like if you're expansionary in either of those things, you know, that's addressing output at the expense of kind of potentially raising prices. Or if you're contractionary, you're kind of trying to rein in inflation, but you're reducing output. And it's like, there's no real clear way through monetary or fiscal policy to like cure stagflation, or at least it's not obvious kind of what you should do. Jason, do you want to kind of talk about what they did do, or you want to say something else on that?
Well, no, I think that I think you touch on everything there. I mean, I think for listeners, it's important maybe to think that, you know, when during this capitalism 2.0, we should expect, you know, real wages to rise as productivity is rising. And in part that could spur inflation, right? That's the idea. But what happens is when so those things should be kind of positively correlated. They should kind of be moving together, but it doesn't happen. And that's weird, right? When those two things diverge. And so that's a big, that's like a big problem in whether it's a bug in the software, using the analogy of the authors. And it's a very, very difficult problem to fix. You know, something that Japan had been kind of facing for almost decades, actually. And so it's always in the mind of policymakers to make sure that we steer ourselves away from that idea of stagflation.
We should, the authors don't touch on this, but it's super important. Like when they talk about recessions, they almost always talk about them as like demand side.
Yeah.
Recessions that like there's some sort of reduction in aggregate demand and the government spending and or like lower interest rates through like expansionary monetary policy can pull us out of these recessions. And like, yeah, that's just not true. So in the 70s, the authors really focus on like an increase in cost through labor, right? So right, labor's strong, you got a lot of labor unions, wages go up. So what happens when, you know, the cost of firms go up? Well, they raise prices. Well, if prices go up and labor's strong, they're gonna negotiate higher wages and you get this kind of price wage spiral. That's what, yeah, there, which is an example of like what we call cost push inflation. So costs, mm-hmm, go up and that pushes prices up and you get this kind of spiral. I think a more common explanation, or one that's like equally valid, and we'll never know kind of what drove exactly like what factors accounted for X percent of stagflation in the 70s, but like the oil shocks were a huge deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, so like the shocks in the 70s, whether 73 or 79, or supply shocks, right? It's like embargoes, it's a huge increase in the cost of oil. When the cost of oil goes up, the cost of all firms goes up. It's just because oil is so ubiquitous as an input. And like when costs go up, what happens to what firms do? Well, they raise prices, right? And so you have this kind of like, you have strong labor driving kind of higher costs for firms. You have oil shocks that are driving higher costs for firms. Like these are, you can kind of think of these as supply shocks. And like what happens if you have a negative shock to supply? Prices go up, output goes down, right? That's like standard principles of micro or macro. And so that's kind of, that's one explanation for, or like one primary or two primary factors in stagflation. I think another equally valid explanation that I kind of subscribe to is like the role of monetary policy in the 70s. So if you look at like real interest rates, where we're thinking about like nominal interest rates minus inflation, like real interest rates are like historically low in the 70s. They're like -1 to 2%. So they're like even lower than they are today. So even though if you went to the bank and you wanted a loan, the interest rate you might be charged is something like 10%, 11%, 12%, which sounds like a lot. But if you have 10%, 11%, 12% inflation at the same time, like the money you're giving back to the bank every year, it's exactly the same. It's worth exactly the same amount. And so even though nominal interest rates are high in the 70s, real interest rates are really historically low, even lower than they are today. We'll post a link with kind of like a time series of real interest rates that shows this pretty well. And so like the one explanation is just that like loose monetary policy, right? That like there's a lot of money being circulated through the money supply, through borrowing and lending, like that's driving inflation, right? That's like kind of the monetaristic explanation. This would be like the Milton Friedman explanation that like, why do you get inflation? Well, inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon, okay? And like that's the Milton Friedman explanation. So the authors tend to be more Keynesian and they kind of attribute stuff to demand, whereas like the story with the 70s is, I think, more of a supply story, and they don't really do a good job of explaining that.
So what do you think our current recession is?
It's like both.
It's both, right? And I bring that up because I think a lot of us subscribe to the idea that it's both supply and demand, you know, generated, which I think is really interesting. You usually see these supply shocks that then finally perpetuate into demand shocks, which happened with us, but ours seem to be like a simultaneous event.
Yeah, if you have global disruptions to supply chains, you know, combined with all these kind of protectionist policies of the Trump administration and other, you know, countries, like all these things should raise prices, right? Right, like, you know, My wife was like shopping for appliances recently. She's ticked off because of the tariffs on
washing
appliances
machines
and things like that. So like some prices are going up, but a lot of prices are remaining constant or going down. And like in the aggregate, Jason, do you know what inflation is right now? Like what CPI is?
CPI is just a touch over 2%, and core PCE, that's basically like consumer expenditures. That is just a touch under 2%. So they're
right around the Fed's target, which is like actually a little bit higher than what we've been for the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this was just a supply story, we'd expect to see prices going up. Now, if people are kind of concerned about the future due to the pandemic and like aren't spending and saving or, you know, kind of using stimulus checks to pay off debt instead of like actually spending on real goods and services, like that's not going to drive prices. That's going to be like disinflationary. And so kind of the fact that we don't see prices kind of skyrocketing signals that like, and we see a huge reduction in output, signals that it's got to be kind of some combination of both of these things.
So like, they talk about, you know, that we're having these resets, and I guess with capitalism 3.0, we never had like a really hard reset with some of the software. We just kind of, I don't know, tweaked the code, you know, to run with the analogy. And the, you know, the authors then indicate, well, that kind of fueled this anger that a lot of people were seeing. And I think that's really interesting. And I'm wondering if, like, you know, this was written, you know, during the Trump administration, but pre-pandemic, I'm wondering if we'll actually see kind of a reset in some ways, whether that be kind of the hardware or the software.
So maybe we should be clear. So the Volcker Federal Reserve kind of drives up interest rates in a contractionary way to control inflation. We get kind of double dip recessions in the early 80s. And then where are the authors going to say capitalism 3.0 ends?
Right about at the financial crisis.
Okay.
So that's their take, is that capitalism 3.0 kind of resets right on the financial crisis. But we never really have like a reset after that, right? There's no like capitalism 4.0 per se.
Yeah, that was a big question that I had is, I mean, should we even have a capitalism 4.0? Like, I know that they look at history in like a progressivist kind of way by going from like capitalism is, you know, moved on from 1.0 to 2.0 to 3.0. And that's where it does end in like 2009. So like, if you're saying it hasn't rebooted, is it worth rebooting? Is it something where we can,
I think it is, right? Yeah. Right. So I think like, this is like the biggest question. I think that's something that we're seeing, you know, across, you know, the United States right now. And I would have to argue that my speculation would be that it is going to be kind of some sort of hardware reboot, right? The way that our institutions run, I think, are going to be reset in some ways. The social unrest that you're seeing from whether it be the left or the right, I think requires some sort of, you know, resetting of the hardware, our institutions that run, you know, the code here. And I don't know where that starts though.
This is getting kind of ahead of ourselves, but you know, in the fifth dialogue, they're going to outline their ideas for like, okay, here are a whole set of tools that we can use to reboot the system and fix some of these problems. Maybe we should talk for a second about like the bugs in 3.0 and what they see as like what went wrong in kind of in the lead up to the financial crisis and during the financial crisis. And then we'll kind of think about like, are those things persistent today? And if so, are we kind of like still cruising for a bruising, you know, and needing a reboot after this?
I do. Yeah. Like I definitely have a lot of questions especially about 3.0. So moving on from 2.0, as far as the way that they describe it, 3.0 is like what we call neoliberalism. It's like opening up the markets. It is, it's like globalizing everything from like production to like labor.
Yeah.
And you can really, and you can invest anywhere. Like banks seem to have a lot more influence than they would have had in 2.0. It also seems like it's really like volatile. Like there's, at least in the way that they described it, there's more cause for recession. I'm sure there's a ton of different causes for that. Was 3.0 like a big improvement on 2.0? And I'd really like to hear you guys' thoughts on that.
I would say that, yeah. I mean, like 3.0 is like significantly different than 2.0. Mm-hmm. So like the Great Moderation or whatever you want to call it, the rise of neoliberalism, like it definitely has certain characteristics that are definitely better than the 70s and before then. And this is all kind of from an economic standpoint. Like the fact that like inflation volatility is just like not eliminated, but significantly reduced. Like just the fact that, you know, people have like stable expectations of prices in the 80s and more so in the 90s, 2000s, and now. I mean, like that is good for consumers. That is good for firms. Now we can quibble about like, you know, if the Federal Reserve is missing their target, well, that's only 1.5% instead of 2%. Like that's what actually like, that's like what we debate about. Like it's what we argue about. Like, and that's a whole lot better to be arguing about that from a monetary policy perspective than arguing about like, oh shit, like inflation's 15% this year, but we also have like, you know, 1% growth. Like, what do we do? Like, you know, I mean, like we, I think we're a little bit ungrateful for that. At least like economists are, we like to kind of like, just nitpicking whatever. Jason, what else is better about the sort of neoliberal era than capitalism 2.0 or version 2.0?
I just think about the like the standard of living is just accelerated globally, not just in the United States, for so many different countries. And that's just because of the opening of borders and the globalization. And that just wasn't possible prior to neoliberalism, right? Capital basically stayed local, and there's benefits to that. I don't want any mail that says that Jason's terrible and hates America, but I mean, there are obvious global benefits to opening borders and letting kind of capital travel that way.
Yeah, we should not downplay the fact that like economic growth has brought billions of people out of poverty, out of abject poverty. That shouldn't be overlooked. Now, like, you know, from just a sort of US centric perspective, you know, I mean, we have lost a lot of like high quality, kind of middle class manufacturing jobs. And like when those things leave, it doesn't just kind of like, it's not just the, like some people lose their jobs when a plant closes. My mom's from Janesville, Wisconsin. And like when the GM plant closed, it's like, I mean, it just like shatters the entire community. Because all those kind of businesses that are dependent on that revenue coming in from the incomes coming in from all those employees, you know, you just kind of get an exodus of like young and like middle-aged people leaving like this huge gap in the city. So, and we also know that, like, I think that's associated with depression and drug use and all sorts of stuff. So like there's all sorts of nasty stuff that's associated with globalization. If you want to criticize the US, I think a fair criticism is that like we haven't provided enough of a social support system to people that have been impacted by rapid changes in not just trade. Like trade is like the go-to like villain, but like technological progress. I mean, like technological progress has displaced a whole lot of people, as you know, as people go from, you know, working in like textiles to, or whatever, working on the line, doing something. They're like, no, actually, like robots can do this. You know, Elon Musk has figured out a plan.
And I think like that's like a fundamental flaw in some of the institutions that like that is why people are angry right now, right? And there's no it didn't feel like there was any reset after, you know, the financial crisis, and that, you know, that gave rise to populism, nationalism, I mean, globally. So that's when I speculate to say, like, that's where I think, you know, the next phase, the next capitalism 4.0 is going to come, is like in a hardware update. That's exactly why.
So I'm going to list the bugs that they identify. They identify three bugs in 3.0. And then we're going to play a game. So the bugs that they identify, that kind of led up to the financial crisis, I don't think anybody's going to really debate at least two of these. I don't think anybody's seriously going to debate that, like, there's been an increase in income inequality in the United States, and that leverage, like debt by banks, like whether they're kind of traditional banks or like the shadow banking system, like non-traditional financial institutions, or just like big insurers and big companies, right? Jason, how much gets traded in like overnight money markets? It's every day.
Oh, I mean, it's got to be close to trillions.
I think it's like actually, yeah, it's more than like $1 trillion.
Yeah.
It's traded like every day.
Every day.
Yeah. And so like if you're using these mortgage-backed securities as collateral, and then all of a sudden these things, you're not sure that they're worth it, like all of a sudden this $1 trillion that's like floating around every day, like seizes up. And then like, mm-hmm. that's when the shit hits the fan. And like, that was like, there were weekends when they're like, all right, if we don't fix this, if we don't inject liquidity into these financial markets, like there's going to be a global financial crisis with like, that was that would have been much more serious than what we actually saw. Like GE wouldn't have been able to pay their employees, and like mm-hmm. all of a sudden, like really bad, you know, the way it's told is that like incredibly bad things would have happened if these quote unquote bailouts didn't happen.
And I mean, that was, to bring it back a little bit to today, because, you know, our younger listeners probably don't remember the financial crisis all that much. You know, they're just a little bit younger than Johnny. So like, that's why the Federal Reserve's actions today during this pandemic were so lauded, because they wanted to mitigate any kind of those liquidity issues right away. They committed so much money, even though it might not have been needed at the time, but just the idea of having this backstop there, this commitment, it was there. And like, it was so important for that to happen.
All right, so we're gonna play a game about inequality. So this is, I'm going to take a passage from Reinventing the Bazaar, A Natural History of Markets by John McMillan, which is one of my favorite books. And I'm not going to read the passages.
Bazaar, like, oh, that's crazy. Or bazaar, like
inventing like the bazaar, like the, like the, if you go to Istanbul, like there's like the,
oh yeah, the market, bazaar, right? Yeah, like the way that people market, like the mall, it's like the,
it's a book about markets. Okay.
Yeah.
And, okay, so take half of the world's population. About half of the world's population lives on less than $2 a day, right? So like abject poverty, okay? And that's a lot of people, and that's atrocious, okay? Now, suppose you look at like the top 0.1% of the population. So the top 0.1% of the population consumes, like they spend in consumption every year about as much as the poorest 45% of the population. Okay, so the top 0.1% of the population spends about as much as, like, let's say the bottom 50%. That's an exaggeration. We'll say whatever, bottom 45%. All right, so if we look at, suppose you took all of the wealth of that top 0.1%, okay, the ultra, ultra, ultra rich, and you cut it up, okay, and you gave it to the bottom 45%, the people that are living on $2 a day. Okay, so you take all the wealth from the top 0.1%, wealth, not income, just like wealth, what they've accumulated, and you give it to, like, say the bottom 50% of the world. How much money do you think you've given them in US dollars?
Probably somewhere at like $100.
Yeah, I'd probably say around like $400 or something.
Well, you guys aren't any fun, because like, you guys are downplaying it, because I pose this as like a riddle. It's $9,000. Okay.
Oh, that's way more than I would have thought.
Yeah, because I'm thinking like,
so what are some of the, because I was like,
all right, put this in context. Like, when people call for radical wealth redistribution, all right, think about it. Let's take from the top 1% and let's give it to the rest of the people. Like, what have you done? Like, you've given them a check for $9,000. Like, that is like taking all of the wealth of the ultra rich and giving it to the bottom half of the population. You haven't really given them much at all, which to me, whether it's $100 or $400 or $9,000, right? Whatever.
Wait. You don't think $9,000 on $2 a day is a lot of money?
That's a one-time thing. That's a one-time payment. That's not a flow.
Yeah, right. But their stock is so much better. They can live on $2 a day, no problem. They're not like hand to mouth anymore.
$2 a day is what, like $700 a year?
But like, what would be, so I think like to put this, okay, I don't want to, I agree. Like, I don't want to come off as being like some insensitive jerk that's like, you know, poor people should be poor. I don't think that at all.
What's poverty line in the US? It's like for like a family of four, it's like somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Do you really want to like make the argument that a one-time payment of $9,000 to people is like ultra life-changing?
But like, yeah, in a country where, you know, things are like very cheap, it is life-changing.
Yeah, I'd probably have to agree. Because didn't you guys have like a guest on who she had talked about how
we
like
giving
people like $400 in
Lakshmi.
I don't remember. Yeah. Was enough to get people who are really entrepreneurial, that gives them a lot of like that lets them build a business.
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
You all are looking at this counterfactual completely backwards. What happens if you take all of the wealth from the top 0.1%? Like, who are the most productive
individuals
on the planet?
Not the top 1%. They're the best capital owners. No, they're the best capital owners. They're not the most productive.
Ridiculous. Who creates the most value in the US? It's like Bezos, Elon Musk.
But it's not him personally. It's not him personally.
Going to get you fired from Mendoza for saying that. Like,
he's just a great capital owner. He's just a fantastic capital owner. That's it.
You don't think Jeff Bezos has created a shit ton of value for the United States?
I do not think that Jeff Bezos personally does that. I think if you remove Jeff Bezos's wealth, then Amazon continues to be a huge productive driver.
No, yeah,
you didn't say just income, you said wealth, like what they have accumulated. You didn't say like income.
He destroyed the incentive to generate wealth.
Amazon is so far beyond that.
What I have proposed is even more radical than the most radical communist experiments that we've done before. And you all are arguing that this is reasonable. I don't even know kind of where to start to pick this apart. I think we need to move on. Okay.
All right, so let's just assume that I agree with you. Oh my God, that's crazy. Whoa, $9,000. What are you? Oh my God, are you a communist? Are you what?
Okay, let's do it in the context of the US. In the context of the US, if you gave everybody $9,000,
yeah. I think that's a one time thing. I mean, people are already getting $1,200, right? $2,000. Right.
The point of that thought experiment was to tell you that like income redistribution is hard. Wealth creation is hard. So the story is a bust. Where does that leave us? So I think one thing that's kind of come back up repeatedly is like, is there going to be some sort of like capitalism 4.0 at the end of all this? And like, they're going to give us ideas at the end that were kind of pre-pandemic ideas, which actually I think are useful. Like it's useful to kind of have a bank of good ideas for that way. Once things go wrong, you kind of, at least policymakers have somewhere to go to. I wouldn't say that like not a lot has changed in terms of the bugs that they're attributing to the cause of 3.0. Like we have maybe better financial market regulation. You know, the Fed knows how to respond a little bit better in cases where there's financial instability. That's definitely true. Inequality has not changed. And if anything, the pandemic is going to cause like much larger disparities in inequality in terms of income, in terms of education, in terms of health. kind of leading out of this. There was wage growth. There was good wage growth at kind of the end of the Trump administration leading up to the pandemic. But, you know, a lot of those gains have been wiped out. So we'll see. I don't think I'm ready to kind of take a firm stance on like whether things are going to significantly change as a result of the pandemic relative just to like the change in administration, right? So Biden was, for the listeners, Biden was inaugurated today. And I mean, we will see much different policy decisions. I don't know if that's quite along the lines of like what the authors are saying is the software associated with like these different capitalism regimes.
Yeah, I don't know where that leaves us, right? And I think like there's the bugs that they defined in capitalism 3.0 are continuously perpetuating. And I think that's their point, right? Is that there was no fix at all. There was no reset. And this is what's driving anger, right? And until you fix these things, you're going to continuously get, you know, angry people until something finally gets fixed. And I don't know where that is, right? I think in the United States, at least, it depends, I guess, in who's in political power, right? And so I don't know if within 4 years, the Democrats are going to be able to, you know, reset things.
I mean, but that... The book is appropriately named that like there's still a lot of anger out there. I mean,
we definitely
see that. I mean, a lot of Biden's, you know, inauguration speech was kind of centered around like, you know what, we should bring civility back. You know, well, we'll see. I know a lot of people on the right that aren't quite ready to do that.
That's right.
A lot of people on the left that aren't ready to do that. We'll see.
Oh, maybe that's a good place to end it right now. So instead of speculating any further, we've gone through kind of how they defined macroeconomics with capitalism 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. We've touched on some of the, you know, differences between them, the bugs that kind of perpetuated. And now we're kind of at a spot where we got to think about, you know, how does the current bugs kind of, how do they coincide with the rise in anger that we're seeing right now?
Yeah. And next up is going to be the kind of the micro side. We're going to think about like what's driving private anger in the next episode. Any last thoughts?
I'm glad that I got both of you guys yelling. I feel like
good,
I succeeded.
Next podcast, we promise to be even more angry.
Oh, please.
That's right. I mean, I'm less angry because I've laid the foundation to get Forrest into Mendoza. So I'm less angry there.
Also, you were right. So
that's perfect. Oh, I love that. That is absolutely what we'll end on.
Cheers, guys.
All right.
Cheers.
Talk to you guys later.